Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. I find myself holding on to the word gratitude, as if it were a stepping stone toward a healthier me and healthier world. From the moment I rise in the morning, I'm grateful to be able to stand vertically and breathe. Everything that follows is a gift. About a month ago, my husband and I jumped in the car and headed north towards Santa Barbara. We drove the 150 past Lake Casitas, where a few years back small creeks ambled down surrounding mountains, coming to rest in the vast lake. Cranes and egrets visit less frequently now, and deer venture closer to the water's edge, wary of the beasts they fear will shortly follow. Merging onto the 101, we drive north past Santa Barbara. We're searching for empty space, or at least a place where we can take off our masks and breathe in the salty air. My husband tells me the stories of his youth, a time when to get to the surf breaks, he and a group of friends would park their cars at Gaviota, pile surfboards into a dinghy, and make their way to the ranch. That was the only way kids like us could surf there, he says, shakes his head, then continues. That hasn't changed. He turns left into a campground. The place is packed with Winnebagos. He turns around and continues north. Just before the 101 turns inland, he does a U-turn, and for a moment, I think he's giving up and going home. But he pulls over, parks next to the railroad tracks, turns off the car. I grab the day pack and follow him across the tracks and down a narrow path of sorts, over rocks, and make the final jump onto pearl-colored sand. I look around and smile. We're the only two people in a cove edged with wind-shaped rock formations. We choose a rock with a view, and I bring out two thermoses, one with tea for him, another with coffee for me. We drink in silence, knowing how damn lucky we are to be on a beach by ourselves in California in the middle of a pandemic. I think of my family on the other side of the Pacific Ocean and of beaches from my childhood. Wild, howling winds, the crash of surf, of undertows, and running, always running. Mum would bring out thermoses of hot, strong coffee sweetened with condensed milk and sandwiches and tea cake. I finish my coffee and look up to see my husband paddling in the water. I walk toward the cliff face, take photos, and enjoy the solitude. On the way back, we see a few people climbing down the narrow path. I pick up the backpack, take one last look at the cove, and we make our way back to the car. Neither of us says much on the drive back home. The gift of solitude has blanketed us in gratitude. 45 minutes later, my husband pulls into the driveway. I undo my seatbelt, look at him. Thank you, I say. I needed that. Today, I'm in Santa Barbara, California, speaking with Eric Kelly, owner of The Book Den. I'm not aware of another indie bookshop that, in order to keep the shop alive, ship 40 tons of books from one city to another. The Book Den's history begins in 1902 in Oakland, California. So, Eric, how did the bookshop end up 300 miles south in the beautiful city of Santa Barbara, California?
Well, so in the first couple of decades, the Book Den had three owners. There were two brothers who were the ones who founded it, and they sold it or closed it and somebody else took it over in 2 years. And then a man named Raoul, whose father was the first librarian at UC Berkeley, bought it and ran it until his early death at only 45 in 1928. So at that point, Max Richter, who had grown up in Santa Barbara, bought the store and ran it in Oakland for 5 years and then decided he really wanted to come back to Santa Barbara, a reasonable man. And so that's where the 40 tons of books on the railroad car comes in.
And what year would that have been?
We're talking, well, we moved here in 1933.
And I'm guessing they relocated by train, correct?
Yes. It opened up at 15 East Annapa Moose Street on the ground floor of the Oddfellows building. And we actually, I can't say we've been here ever since, because for about 10 years, we moved next door and then came back.
And that was another big move.
Right. But at least in what was nice was that we could put bookcases on wheels and we could just push them next door. We didn't have to put them in boxes and put them on a truck and then unload them at some other location. So as moves go for a bookstore, it was relatively easy.
And what year did you become involved with the Book Den?
That was 1979. I had been working for Brentano's Bookstore, which was a national chain, first in Marin County and then in downtown San Francisco. But eventually I wanted to go out on my own, and I was introduced to a man who became my business partner, Michael Isidore. And we were looking around the Bay Area to try to find either a store to buy or a location, and we weren't finding very much. So we thought we would just like take a drive down through Southern California and see what we could find. So on January 26th, 1979, we came into Santa Barbara, and we found at the Chamber of Commerce a list of the bookstores, and the closest one was the Book Den. And we came in, and this very nice woman said hello, and we said, "Now, do you know if any of the bookstores in town are for sale?" And she said, "This one is." And this was my birthday, my 27th birthday. So then negotiations were had, and as of April 1st, April Fool's Day, which is, I think, a brilliant day to go into business, Michael and I owned the bookstore. And then I ended up buying him out about 4.5 years later, very amicably.
So, Eric, I guess you're a lifer bookseller.
Yeah, I guess this is what I'm doing.
And that's lucky for Santa Barbara. Now, when you and Michael purchased the Book Den in 1979, what were you mainly selling?
Used and antiquarian books. Yeah, general used books and you know, some rare things and so on. It's never been a specialty of ours, but, you know, you run into things. And we also sold used magazines. There was a back room in the store, and there were thousands of them. So it was the old National Geographics and Life magazines and so on. It was just too much work. Also, you know, people would come in the store with bibliographies, right? And they're looking for magazine appearances of, say, Jack London. Well, I can go through the magazines and know that, oh, no, only the Jack London one has been sold. Somebody's gone through that author and, you know, Kerouac and so on. So eventually I just sold the magazines. And we just became basically a used bookstore until about 10 years ago. I mean, I was adding new books, but not a large inventory. We would have some tables of the current paperback bestsellers and so on. In 2010, so 10 years ago, the Borders and the Barnes & Noble closed within a week of each other. So we were basically the only somewhat large bookstore in downtown Santa Barbara. Just seemed like there was an opportunity there to start selling more in the way of used books.
And were you able to buy bookcases from Borders or Barnes & Noble?
Well, actually, I didn't have to buy them. I've managed to sort of scrounge things from other bookstores. I mean, it's almost like being a cannibal or whatever. But, you know, when Earthling Bookstore, which was a wonderful independent, but it had closed when Barnes & Noble and Borders came in, and it couldn't compete. And so a lot of my freestanding bookcases I bought from them. And then when Barnes & Noble closed, the manager called me and she said, "We're talking to all of the bookstores in town. You can have any fixtures you want for free, but they have to be gone the day after tomorrow." I went over there and figured out what I wanted to buy, and you just put a piece of tape on with Book Den on it. And hired a trucking company and rented a storage locker.
And it must have been strange that both those big chains, Borders and Barnes & Noble, closed both their shops in the same area in the same week.
Yeah. And, you know, one was the Borders chain, of course, went bankrupt. And they did manage to sell some of their stores to other chains. But I don't think that there was another chain in Southern California that would have been a good fit. And then the Barnes Noble just came to the same conclusion. Their lease was running out, and they would have needed a big decrease in rent, and it wasn't coming. And, you know, it's not just independent bookstores that get chased out of town by, you know, having to not being able to afford your rent.
Yes, that's true. On the short history page of your website, you write that in 1983, the store acquired its first computer, a venerable K-Pro 4. And later in 1999, you started online. Was that acquiring sales via email?
Actually, there was a company that was a predecessor of Libros, which is one of the online service. I don't even remember what it was called, but it was basically sort of Unix and list servers, and you could post what you had on that. People could browse it, and then that's where the email and so on came in, because rather than ordering it online or whatever, they would call you or send you a text. So that's how we got started, and we opened our first website in 2001. I think we've been trying to be ahead of the curve. I don't know whether that's possible anymore, though.
In looking back with all the changes you've gone through as far as the bookselling world, has there been one change that was exceptionally difficult for you to learn?
Honestly, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of these things had their challenges and so on, but I don't think of one that was particularly hard. The one change that I was sort of regretted a little bit was that in the 90s, I opened another store out in Isla Vista next to the university. We had a great opening day. We sold $500 worth of books. And I thought, oh, this is going to be great. And we never got close to that number again. I had to make the decision to close it. But fair enough. You know, you try things and they don't all work. And what was interesting was, one, I brought the manager, a woman named Rebecca Traver, to the downtown store. So I got her talent where she could actually make me some money. And I was competing with myself more than I knew, because after 2 or 3 months, the downtown store was making as much money as the two stores combined used to. So it turned out that the decision to close it, even if it was hard, was a good one.
And that is a great segue into my next question. Who are the booksellers you have now working in the store with you?
So there are four of us, and we're all men, which is highly unusual in the course of the history of the store. But there is Michael Moore, who's my new book buyer, and he was one of the things I got from Barnes & Noble besides the shelving, because I'd known him for a long time. And he, during Barnes & Noble's boom, he was the guy they sent to the towns to open up a new store, hire the people, get everything going, and then they would send him someplace else. And he got kind of tired of it. And he'd lived in Santa Barbara, so he asked to be transferred to the Santa Barbara store. And of course, he was glad of a job. And I ran into him on the street and I said, it occurs to me, I need a new book buyer. And so he's been working with me ever since, and has really helped the transition to where we are. Our profits are probably half and half from new books and used books. And it was really wonderful having his experience and his book knowledge. And then there's Joaquin Gray. He had worked for Borders. Actually, we figured out that Joaquin was born 2 weeks after I bought the store. So it makes him younger than me, but I mean, he's 40. So, and he's kind of my technical whiz kid, because he's a pretty adept programmer. And I'd done some of the early versions, but he's made everything much slicker and so on. This computer that I'm talking on, you know, in the space of about 2 hours, he had it up and running. And he's also the shipper for our internet business, which is sizable these days. And when my used book buyer left several years ago, he became the used book buyer, because he's been working in the store for so long that he really knows. He came as a bookish guy, which all of us are. And then my most recent hire is Joe Marsh. I got turned on to him by another bookseller the owner of Mesa Books, and he said, you know, you should really hire my brother, because he's a good book guy, and he's like the hardest working person I've ever met. Absolutely true. I mean, Joe is just great. He's also worked in every bookstore in town. He was worked for Osborne's Books, which was a store that was founded in 1888 and closed in the mid-70s, I think. And he worked for Chaucer's, and he worked for Earthling, and now he's working for me. So I am very lucky. And I've actually, my whole career, I've been very lucky in finding really bright people who stay a long time.
My next question is probably more of a pre-COVID related question, but how has online book selling affected the overall business of brick and mortar bookshops?
Well, the trouble with online and COVID is that, again, Amazon has gotten the lion's share of it, in part just because people needed everything else and they didn't want to go out to grocery stores or drugstores or whatever. And even people who weren't shopping on Amazon started to. And once you start, it's pretty addictive. I mean, I have to say that that website is pretty slick. You know, you can buy something with two clicks. So, you know, since this spring, Amazon has gotten more of than its share, which it always has. The bookstores that are successful are the ones that were already doing a lot of online business. Although certainly a lot of the larger bookstores, surprisingly, you know, are in trouble, like Powell's and the Strand. Yeah. And I heard Tattered Cover just found new buyers, which is great. For us, we're new and used, and it's fairly amazing how many new books we sell at full price. And this has gone up this year, and this is my customers wanting to buy it from me rather than Amazon. But also, on the used book side of it, it's a way of selling books that it would be very hard for a small independent store to sell. I get some really wonderful, weird books, but I could be 10 years waiting for somebody to walk into my small shop in a sleepy town in Southern California. Whereas online, and which I've been doing for 20 years now, I can sell that book in Helsinki.
And is there a strong market for rare books in the private sector for private collectors?
It's changed, and I don't think that there are as many collectors of anything as there used to be. You know, the 1980s and 1990s were such a boom for collecting modern first editions. And obviously the really important things, I mean, the Dickens first editions or Hemingway or Jane Austen or whatever, those will always command things. The things that are not quite that scarce have really, frankly, lost in value. Because one of the things that the online bookselling did was showed you every copy of that book that's for sale in the whole world. So a book that I might see only every 5 years, well, it does happen that there are 73 of them for sale on ABE.
Eric, could you just explain to our listeners, please, what ABE is? And I'll be sure to put the link in the show notes.
ABA is Advanced Book Exchange. And it's one of the aggregators where I'm sure there are well over 10,000 stores around the world that list their books for sale there. So my books show up on a screen with everybody else's. And we try to have very good condition things. So, and we can charge more money for that. Somebody else might be selling a trashy copy of it for a penny plus shipping. Whereas we can get $6 or $7 for it. Well, no, because we don't even sell books that cheap. $10 for it, if we have a really good one.
And is there one book you've held in your hands where you've thought, oh my, this one is really special?
Just for the cool factor, not because of personal interest and so on. Well, about 10 years ago, I bought a collection of books on Native Americans and most of it on Cherokee. And there were fascinating things, you know, newsletters of the Pocahontas Club in Oklahoma talking about when they first arrived in Oklahoma and what happened. So it was a wonderful lot. In it was an American Bible in Cherokee, printed in like 1862 or somewhere around there. and it was in beautiful condition because it was made on really good cotton paper, and the cover was in good shape, and it was printed by the American Bible Society, and the only words in the book were American Bible Society in English. The rest of it was completely in Cherokee.
And did you end up keeping that book?
No, I broke the collection up, but that one book was the high spot. I sold it to another dealer. My suspicion is that actually I think he bought it for himself.
Now, years ago, you adopted two cats, Blanche and Beardsley, who were fixtures at the bookshop for 20 years. Do you have a store kitty now?
No, we haven't in a long time. Actually, our current mascot, although he's passed away, as it was my dog Django. On our website and so on, there's a picture of a very wise-looking white German shepherd. He actually wasn't a very good shop dog because he would just get bored. He'd be lying by the front door. At some point, he would get up, walk into the doorway, and turn around, make sure that I saw him. And he would walk out the door, turn left, and walk over to Coffee Cat, whether I followed him or not.
So did he just go by himself, or did you follow him?
Well, I usually was right behind him. But, you know, but it was just, he's going, I'm bored, it's time. So since his passing, he's still our mascot on our logo and so on. I have another dog, but she's a little bit of a wild thing, and I don't think she will be a shop dog.
Yeah, it takes a certain personality, doesn't it? Now, Eric, because the book den has been a large part of your life, you must see a lot of familiar faces walking through the door and have a strong connection to the community. Every bookseller I speak with says they depend on their communities to help them through tough times, like we're currently experiencing, and likewise the indie bookshops help their communities. How is the book den involved with the Santa Barbara community?
One of the first civic things I got involved in upon buying the store was I joined the Friends of the Library for the Santa Barbara Public Library. They are right across the street, and the store has had a long, good relationship with them. So that got me into sort of that sort of public service thing. And for a while, I was on the similar Friends of the Library for the University of California at Santa Barbara until that one was disbanded by the university. And then I was on the Downtown Association of Santa Barbara for about 16 years, and I was president for a couple of years of that time. Downtown Santa Barbara, as I'm sure you know, is very unique in the sense that everything in it is in the Spanish colonial architecture. And so we have a improvement district to raise money, and basically it's functions almost as a sort of a small government or whatever. And so that was a perfect fit because, you know, we would tackle things like homeless and panhandling and so on, trying to find reasonable solutions for problems like that. You know, complain to the city council if this or that didn't please the merchants and so on. And then beyond that, it's just supporting the Planned Parenthood.
And are you involved with the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday 2021 Essay and Poetry Contest?
Yeah, well, that was just one. Actually, I do want to be more formal in my relationship with them, but that was just something that they were doing, and I saw an opportunity to promote it. My entree into that is a longtime customer, Sojourner Kincaid Roll, who is a Black poet. And she grew up in South Carolina, and I've known her for maybe 35 years or something like that. And so she's my real connection to that community, and I try to support whatever she's involved in. She's also kind of a good story because we've known each other all of this time. And one time we got talking about our youth and so on, and I said, well, you know, I grew up in Germany, and I was going to the military schools, and she said, oh, what school? And I said, Munich American High School. She goes, oh, I went there. Her father was in the military, and so it was about 4 years earlier than I, but it was kind of just this cool thing. Yeah.
That's a wonderful story. Now, if somebody had a library that they'd inherited or a book collection, How would they go about contacting you to see if you would be interested in having a look?
Basically, it's best just to call so we can sort of go, well, what is this? Is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? How old are the books? What kind of condition they're in? And so on. And so then once we've sort of sorted that out where it might be something that we would be interested in, then the next question is, how many books are there? And do you want to sell them or do you want them appraised? Because we do that too. And sometimes I don't even need a formal appraisal. They just say, I want to give this to charity, but I don't want to give away a $5,000 book in case there's one in here. So then, you know, if it's 10 boxes of books or whatever, we go, you know, if you can fit them in the back of your car or whatever, we'd really rather see them here. But otherwise, I go out and look, we bring them back and we figure out what we can sell them for and then make an offer based on that. And the other thing we've been doing all along is if people take it and trade, we give them 20% more.
And when you merchandise the books in the store, do you put the new and used books side by side or do you have separate areas for both?
We do it side by side. Because, I mean, most of the books we're selling are general books. So, you know, if you want The Long Valley by Steinbeck, well, you might prefer a used one, but, oh, well, we don't have one. Well, oh, but there's a new one there. Sure. Or they come in looking for the new one, and then they go, wow, the used book is right there and right next to it, and it's half the price. So the way we make it easy for the customers is, if the price label on the back of the book is white, it's a used book. And if it's pale blue, it's a new book. So people can tell very quickly what it is.
I went to buy my husband a copy of Barack Obama's book, and I looked at the price, and it was $45 for the hardcover.
But, you know, by the pound is probably a fair price.
I'm not too sure about that. I've printed hardcover books, and they're probably about the same size. The price does seem expensive. However, I'm sure the publishing company needs to make back the money they've put out for the advance, and I'm sure the marketing costs. And indie bookstores can't really buy in bulk, and you can't discount it because the publisher has set the price and it's stamped on the back of the book with the barcode. So it's a real conundrum here with the price of these books.
You know, he's popular enough to command that price, and it is a massive book. We're selling it pretty well.
Well, I've heard it's a beautifully written book, so it's probably worth every penny. I'll just have to save up my pennies. Eric, is there a book, new or old, you'd like to see more people read?
The Elegance of the Hedgehog.
Is that by Muriel Barbery?
Yeah. I have hand-sold. I mean, it's not a hugely important book or anything. It wasn't profound, but it's so charming. The story is basically, there's a 12-year-old girl who lives in a fancy apartment building in Paris. Her parents are wealthy and liberal. And then there is the concierge, a woman in her 50s, who, unbeknownst to her employers, has this massive library in her tiny apartment. Each of them has a journal. And so the chapters go back and forth in their journals, and you know that their stories will eventually converge. And it's just so charming that I keep handing it to people who just say, can you recommend a book that will just make me feel good? So that's it. And I think sometimes that's what we need, and we should honor those things that aren't profound, that aren't literarily important, but are just a successful story.
I couldn't agree with you more, Eric. Now, where can people find the book, Den?
So 15 East Annapurna Street in downtown Santa Barbara, half a block off of State Street. And then we have a website, www.bookden.com. And we're on Facebook. If you do Santa Barbara, you'll see a few of them, but you'll find us pretty easily.
And your phone number?
805-962-3321. Although, just a little funny story, in 1933, the phone number was Woodbridge 2-3321. Because, you know, that when they had the first two numbers were letters.
And the phones looked a little different then, too. Well, thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Before I say goodbye, I would like to read something that is on the What's On page of the Book Den website. There's a photo of Theodore Roosevelt with the words, "When the Book Den first opened its doors, Theodore Roosevelt was president. 20 presidents later, we are proud to welcome President-elect Joe Biden to the list. Let's hope the Book Den is open for another 20 more presidents and beyond." It makes me feel good to see the Book Den is still here.
Well, thank you very much. It does me too. We get people coming in, they go, "We're so glad you're still here." And I go, "Yeah, so am I."
And thanks again for being on the show. If you're enjoying the Bookshop podcast, please consider becoming a patron. For more information, go to www.patreon.com/thebookshoppodcast. Or you can go to my website, mandyjacksonbeverly.com, click on the Bookshop podcast, and you'll find more information about me and the podcast there. From bookshop to author. Arthur Hoyle is a writer, educator, and independent filmmaker. His documentary films have won numerous awards and have aired on PBS, and he received a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. He has produced corporate communications materials in print and video for a broad array of clients. He received bachelor's and master's degrees in English from the University of California, Los Angeles, and has taught English, coached tennis, and served as an administrator in independent schools. While living in Los Angeles, he volunteered as a naturalist in the Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area, leading interpretive walks on Chumash Indian culture. His biography of Henry Miller, The Unknown Henry Miller, was published in March 2014 by Skyhorse Arcade. His second nonfiction book, Mavericks, Mystics, and Misfits, Americans Against the Grain, was published March 17, 2020 by Sunbury Press. He now lives in Santa Barbara, California. Hello, Arthur, and welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Mandy, and delighted to be here talking with you via Zoom.
Likewise, and I'm thankful every day for technology. You grew up in New York and moved to Los Angeles in the early 60s. Did you relocate specifically to attend the University of California, Los Angeles?
Actually, 1960 was when I moved out here to go to UCLA. I was transferring into UCLA from Brown University. I was an East Coast preppy, and when I got to Brown, I kind of thought, I'm still in prep school. So I had spent some time in California visiting my father, who lived in San Marino. And I came out again for another summer and just said, I think I'm going to stay here. You know, so I transferred into UCLA, and I've been in Southern California ever since and in LA for 60 years.
And did you get into the surfing scene here in California?
I did. Yeah, absolutely. My parents, I was blessed. My parents had a house right on the beach near the Malibu Surfrider Beach near the pier. I could walk down the beach to that surf spot with my board and go in the water. So it was like, you know, I was just in heaven. And I surfed, I gave up surfing about 10 years ago. I got to the point where the pain wasn't worth the gain, but I loved it. It was a great sport.
Well, the water temperature in Santa Barbara is definitely cooler than Malibu.
Yes, it is. But back in the day, we used to surf in winter in bareback, no wetsuits. We'd be in 58 degree water without a wetsuit.
Back in the days of Mike Doyle and Mickey Dora, when men were men.
That's right. That's when men were men.
At UCLA, which is a public research university, you received bachelor's and master's degrees in English. How did this education shape your outlook on the world philosophically, socially, and your general overall awareness of life?
Well, that's a big question, but it's quite to the point, I would say. I think I had a kind of awakening or epiphany moment when I began reading literature at UCLA. There was one teacher in particular who I had in a freshman English composition class. I still remember his name, Mr. Miller. We were doing, you know, compositions, and then there was a literary criticism class that he taught subsequently, and I took that class. And the first book he assigned us to read was Camus' The Stranger. And I read the first sentence of that novel, and a big light bulb went off in my head. That just put me on the path to studying literature. It was just such a moment of realization and seeing myself as part of a much bigger context and much bigger world. It just sort of took me out of myself, and I liked that feeling. So books, you know, just took me on journeys, and I loved reading.
One of my sons is a double Bruin, and after spending time visiting him, I found myself being drawn back there to the libraries to do research. And specifically, I adore the Sculpture Garden. It's such a wonderful place to go and read, a sanctuary slap bang in the middle of the West Side. Would you agree?
I would. And it's changed a lot over the years from when I, you know, first went there. The North Campus hadn't been built. There was just a what they called a gypsy wagon up there, where it was like a food concession up there. But, you know, then gradually they added all these buildings and the research library and the sculpture garden so that, you know, it's just an absolutely beautiful location. It's my favorite place on campus to go. And I spent a lot of time in the research library, both as an undergraduate, as a graduate, and then when I wrote my Miller book.
I must say, Arthur, I got a little bit of a twinge of nostalgia when you said the name of the teacher who inspired you and his last name being Miller. That's really a sweet story.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that funny?
We'll get more into that a little later. Now, in the 70s, you became a documentary filmmaker. Can you share with us how that came to be, the topic of your documentaries, and your involvement with the 2017 documentary, Henry Miller, Prophet of Desire?
My film involvement began when I was teaching English at the Harvard School in North Hollywood. I started getting very interested in film because there was such a creative explosion in cinema during the 60s. There were just so many great filmmakers here and in Europe making film. It was just a glut, really. And I found it very inspirational. But the film that really kind of knocked my socks off was Frederick Wiseman's documentary, Titicut Follies. I don't know if you've ever seen that film or heard of that film. It was a very controversial film. He made it in an institution for the criminally insane in Massachusetts. And he somehow persuaded the authorities to let him come in with his camera. And he used the technique that he's famous for of just running the camera and letting it record and you know, just making the camera a witness. And what was disclosed was so horrifying, the way these men were treated. By the end of the movie, you couldn't tell who was crazier, the people that were the inmates or the people who were running the place. And it was so powerful a movie and so disturbing a movie that they tried to censor it. They tried to prevent it from being shown because on the grounds that it was invading the privacy of the inmates, you know, they were using that hypocrisy. But that film just kind of woke me up to what you could do with a camera, you know, how you could be, again, a witness to reality, not an invented reality, an actual reality. And so I started reading up a lot. I became an autodidact on cinema. And then I started teaching cinema appreciation in my English classes, getting around the curriculum, you know, conundrum by saying, oh, these are writing prompts. You know, I assign them movies to go to, and then they have to write a review. So, you know, I got it under the wire, you know, as literature. And then I started a film club there, got some equipment. And then one of my students took out one of the cameras one weekend and shot some footage of beef cattle being unloaded from a boat onto a truck to be taken to a feedlot. They had been out in a pasture. you know, grazing for about a year, getting ready to go to the feedlot. And I was just like really struck by this footage. And I saw a lot of metaphoric potential in it. So I asked him if we could collaborate on turning that one little bunch of footage that he had gotten just over a weekend, turning it into a movie about the life cycle of one of these animals. And that film was called Cattle, and it was finished in 1972. It was my first film made with Alan. It got me on the path. It showed at a lot of film festivals, won a lot of awards, and you know, made me think I was a filmmaker. You know, it gave me that kind of belief. Although I really didn't know what I was doing, I was like literally putting one foot in front of the other as I made the movie. I had no idea what I was doing. It was just sheer dumb luck, you know, beginner's luck that it came out the way it did. There were some times in the movie when, in order to keep the continuity going, I had only one shot that would possibly get me across a bridge. And somehow that shot always turned up. You know, it was like without any planning, it was just like the footage was there. So it also gave me faith in the idea that you can go out and shoot kind of improvisationally, that you don't need to have a plan in advance, that you can be in the moment with the camera and trust that later in the editing room, you'll put something together that makes sense. So that kind of guided my my thinking about how to make documentaries, but that doesn't work very well in the system. You know, if you're putting up a proposal to make a film and you want money, you can't just say, well, I'm going to take the camera out and shoot and see what happens. You know, you're not going to get very far doing that. So that was how that came about. And then my films were, I would say, eclectic. After the Cattle film, I made a film about the American poet, Carl Shapiro, who was my favorite American poet. And he was at the time living and teaching at UC Davis. I had taught his poetry in my English classes. And so I got a hold of him and said, would you cooperate with me on a film? And we made a nice little film about his poetry. And then I did a film about professional wrestling, which turned out to be, I was ahead of my time on that, seeing the potential for commentary on our culture that comes from professional wrestling. It's a kind of almost like a satire on capitalism. So then my final film, I made films for about 10 years. My final film was a documentary about a building in Los Angeles that was going to be demolished, even though it was on the National Register of Historic Places. It was about that conflict between Los Angeles' kind of compulsive need to, you know, reinvent itself over and over and over again, and people who want there to be a heritage and you know, some kind of architectural continuity in the city.
This isn't the first time the subject of gentrification has come up in this podcast, and one that I care deeply about. It saddens me to see architecturally unique buildings pulled down, and the sweet California bungalows with decades-old fruit trees in their gardens being replaced by multiple-story homes and brick patios. But I do understand that we also need to do something about the housing situation in the cities. I don't know what the answer is.
Well, it has to do, I think, a lot with values, you know, and you need values in the community that respect, you know, tradition and respect, you know, good architecture and care about that. It's an educational process, I think, for the community. I mean, you've got groups like the Conservancy that are working on that, but developers want to turn properties over, and you know, that's how they make money. Now, there is a lot of adaptive reuse going on, especially downtown LA. There's a lot of really creative use happening in these old warehouse buildings that are being turned into artist lofts and
live work opportunities.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's a good sign.
Yes, it is. And getting back to your documentaries, what did you have to do with the Henry Miller Prophet of Desire documentary? Did you work on it or were you an interviewee?
No, I was just interviewed. The producer got hold of me and said he was coming to Los Angeles and would I sit for an interview. you know, I wanted to help him. So I introduced him to Miller's son, Tony. I made arrangements for him to be able to film at Miller's former home in the Palisades. I went over there and rang the doorbell and told them what was going on and asked if they would consent to that. So I was helpful in that way. And then I was happy to sit and answer questions. But I was one of a number of people that he interviewed. He interviewed Erica Young. He interviewed Tom Schiller, who was someone who knew Miller quite well. I never knew Miller in person. And there was a German documentary filmmaker that he interviewed who was very articulate about Henry, you know, really understood him. You know, I was just a willing participant in that project.
And the locations manager too, by the sound of it.
Yeah, a little bit of a location manager. I tried to talk him into going up to Big Sur and visiting the Henry Miller Library up there and maybe even going to Henry's former home on Partington Ridge. But he said he didn't have the budget to travel up there and do that. So that didn't happen. That's too bad.
That's a shame because the area up there is just spectacular.
Yeah. But they're hurting. They're hurting these days. Yeah, they've had fires and slides that have really hurt their economy.
Your recent book, Mavericks, Mystics, and Misfits, Americans Against the Grain, takes the reader on a journey across American history through the lives of exemplary men and women whose stories capture the spirit of their time and place and reveal the American character. When asked in a recent interview about the criteria you used for people in the book, you said, geographical distribution, gender distribution, ethnicity distribution, and education, which, by the way, sounds like a promo for UCLA.
Yeah.
Did this criteria happen organically, or did you set out searching for people throughout American history with these attributes boldly in place?
Well, I wanted to show the melting pot. I wanted to show the country as a mosaic of different peoples who shared, despite all their differences, who shared common values. I mean, that's the whole direction of the book. So I was consciously from the beginning, you know, looking for, you know, what I would consider a representative sampling of who we are as a country and who we've become as a country. But then I also wanted the story to be, in effect, a biography of America, to tell the story of our evolution as a country through these individual life stories. So I had sort of those two driving criteria, I would say, in my selection of the people.
And was there one particular character you wrote about in this book who tugged at your heart? I mean, I'm guessing all of them did, or you wouldn't have written about them. There were actually a few who jumped out at me, Warren Brush and Cynthia Harvenbrush. Perhaps because my two sons have quite a few friends into regenerative farming, so this topic really popped out at me. And I see so many young people getting on board with regenerative farming, and I see it as kind of a revolution. But for you personally, was there one particular character who jumped out at you and you said, yeah, I have to include this person in this book?
Well, I'd say the strongest pull came from Thomas Merton, the monk, and probably Veblen, the sociologist. But I had a lot of history with the Veblen story. My film career kind of crashed and burned over a project that I had developed to make a film for PBS about him and his work that was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. The script was. And this was during the Carter administration. When I came back in with the proposal to, you know, the script and the production proposal and the budget, and you know, I had assembled a team of talent. You know, I had a director. I had, if not a commitment, an expression of serious interest from a major international actor to play Veblen. And you know, I was really excited about the possibility that this voice, which is such a powerful voice, could be broadcast, you know, over PBS in a story form. But when I came back in with my production proposal, William Bennett was the head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. One of the first things he said was he didn't see that there was a role for government funding movies. So my project wasn't funded. My film wasn't funded. So I was still carrying that baggage when I wrote Mavericks, Mystics, and Misfits. I had, you know, this kind of like long-term pregnancy with Veblen. And I had all the research still, you know, I had the script to draw from. So the chapter was, you know, like two-thirds written when I sat down with it. And then I came across some new research that threw a lot of new light on Veblen that it was important. So I was pretty excited, you know, to get that into the book and that the book was published.
You finally delivered the baby.
I finally delivered the baby. And Veblen's analysis of our society and the forces that are operating in it is very powerful. It's very deep. You know, a lot of people don't like it because it's kind of dark. But, we're dark people, you know, humans.
I remember one of the lines you wrote about Veblen was, "Women were the trophies of the chase."
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he recognized misogyny and he recognized exploitation of labor. He recognized a lot of the ills of our patriarchal system. He's a man worth listening to, I think. And then Merton just touched me deeply because of the suffering that he underwent as a child. You know, he really went through a lot of misery. And then, you know, like me, he had this kind of epiphany when he walked into a literature class at Columbia. You know, he sat in by mistake on a class being taught by Mark Van Doren, and that changed his life, you know, and made him a writer, a serious writer. And then that led him on a spiritual path that made him, you know, a religious figure who remained engaged with the world, you know, which is really, if you think about the model of Jesus, you know, he was not off by himself, you know, meditating. He was an activist, you know, who was trying to educate the people around him about, you know, how to live better.
And because he was protected in the monastery where he lived, do you think that allowed him to be so prolific in the subjects that pertained to the day with his writing?
I do. I mean, I think that was, he writes about that, about how it's not enough just to contemplate. You have to turn the fruits of your contemplation into something that's useful in the world. And so his contemplation was what positioned him to write the way that he wrote about the issues that he wrote about. And he was writing about various kinds of injustice, across the sort of the spectrum of social and political issues. He was writing about, you know, nuclear warfare. He was writing about civil rights. He was walking the talk, you know. I mean, he came from a spiritual place, recognizing that what really makes you feel whole is love, and to have a loving relationship with the world. But that's challenging sometimes, to love some of the things that are going on, or to maintain that posture of love, you know, in the face of things that are cruel and are unjust. So I think the monastery gave him a lot of things. I mean, it gave him a feeling of belonging, the community that he really needed. It gave him the place to go inward, to find himself inward. That was really, kind of really important for him. He felt lost, a lost soul. But he engaged, you know, he engaged with the world.
Now, I'd like to talk about your first book, The Unknown Henry Miller. It recounts Miller's career from its beginnings in Paris in the 1930s, but focuses on his years living in Big Sur, California, from 1944 to 1961, during which he wrote many of his most important books, including the Rosy Crucifixion trilogy. I'd like to read a quote of yours. "I began reading Miller in the 1990s and was immediately drawn to him. His personable voice, his message of self-liberation through self-acceptance," end of quote. Could you expand on this phrase of self-liberation through self-acceptance?
Well, I think this kind of takes you really to Buddhism, because one of the premises of Buddhist teaching is that what causes suffering is attachment. You know, we're a people, Americans are a very striving people. You know, we're very attached to our goals. We're very attached to the notion of success. We're very attached to the idea of winning, of being the best. These are all attitudes that are very stressful on us. It's like you're constantly having to do something that will allow you to accept yourself, that you'll feel okay about yourself, that you're okay. So Miller goes off to Paris with $10 in his pocket that he borrows when he's getting on the boat from his best friend, who gives him the last $10 bill in his pocket, and has absolutely no prospects, you know, no plans, no connections, no letter of introduction, no job waiting, no appointment to some academy, and you know, nothing. And then he tells us that he's the happiest man alive. So he's demonstrating that he knows how to be happy without any attachments. I mean, literally living on the street and just bumming, you know, he's just living on the nickel. And I just found that absolutely astonishing that he had not only done this, but that he had written these incredibly brilliant books about his experience doing it. So, you know, that does tie directly into the Mavericks book, because Miller talks about people who are exemplars. And he means by that people who live well, who live fully, who know how to be human. And he writes about the people who are exemplars for him, and they're kind of cut from the same cloth as he is. You know, they're writers, they're artists, they're spiritual figures, D.H. Lawrence, Walt Whitman, Jesus, the Buddha, some of his other artist friends, like Buford Delaney, the painter. But he found people in other walks of life, too, that he considered to be exemplary. So that was...
Thoreau?
Yes, absolutely, Thoreau. So that was kind of like the jumping off point for Mavericks, was like, I'm going to find exemplars that illustrate the story of American history in a very positive way. So that was what set me off on the path.
One of the reasons I created this podcast is because I'm fascinated with personal stories, in particular, what brought us to this point in our lives. I search for the beacons that have been lit, like stepping stones that lead us to the point where we are now. For example, your English teacher in college who inspired you to read could have had any name, but his name was Mr. Miller. And then you went on later in your life to write this book about Henry Miller. And then you wrote about exemplars, something which Miller was interested in also. So it's these little stepping stones that when I'm speaking with people, I just love finding them. It's like finding gems and realizing everything is connected.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
While this pandemic has unsettled us emotionally and physically, I find myself becoming somewhat used to the restrictions and have discovered ways to bring comfort and harmony to each day. What gives you comfort in this time? Food, shelter, safety, companionship?
Well, in the first place, COVID hasn't altered my routine that much. It's cut into my social life to some extent. We don't have dinners with friends unless we can, you know, find a restaurant where we can really be spaced out. But we don't go over to people's houses for dinner. We don't have people in for dinner. So that's, you know, a limitation. But the daily routine for me is pretty much the same as it was, because I'm, you know, you're writing, you're reading. It's a solitary activity. My main physical activities are hiking and playing tennis. I can play tennis with COVID-19 around, and I can go hiking, you know, with COVID-19 around. So I don't have to give that up. And bike riding, I like to go bike riding. And then, of course, we've just moved here from LA, you know, and we bought this house that is it kind of in the country, although it's only 4 minutes from Trader Joe's.
And you relocated from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara.
Yeah, Santa Barbara. So we're getting this house in order because it, you know, it's kind of an old funky house and it needs a lot of TLC. So we're very busy with that. We're running out to the hardware store and Bed and Bath and, you know, doing all that stuff and fixing things up, making our nest. I mean, I have to wear a mask when I go into Ace Hardware, but okay, I'm wearing a mask. So at the personal level, it hasn't really affected me that much, but it has affected me psychologically, seeing the way our country has responded to it and seeing how deeply embedded this disrespect for science has become in our culture. And that's very worrying because, you know, any historian will tell you that science and the Enlightenment are the basis of democracy. And if you start pillorying science and truth, you know, you're just cutting away at the very foundations of the country. And people that talk about, you know, their right to, you know, not wear a mask if they don't want to wear a mask, and with total disregard for their own health and the health of other people that they're going to, I mean, to me, it's just like, I'm just like flabbergasted that there's that many people willing to do that.
Yes, the lack of disrespect for science-based facts is unbelievable.
Well, I think it's going to be an ongoing battle. My own sense of it is that our culture kind of has gone into a kind of warp speed because of the digital revolution. It's brought about so much change so rapidly that many people can't handle it. There are many people are disoriented by it and angry about it one way or another for one reason or another. It's killed off their employment. It's changed the world in a way that makes it harder for them to understand their place in it. And so they want to put the brakes on. They don't want this to happen. So there's this whole counter narrative that's been developed. It's been cynically developed, you know, by people who have control of large media empires, a financial reason for wanting to promote this narrative. And a lot of people, you know, have bought into it. These people, by and large, are not as well educated as many other people are, so they're more susceptible to it. Social media have played a big role in it because of the amount of information that's floating around that enables, you know, conspiracy theories and this explanation and that explanation for things. Even if you read the opinion page of the New York Times, where you think, well, I'm going to find really responsible journalism here, and these are really thoughtful people, you're going to see a whole spectrum of opinion explaining why this or that happened. Nobody really knows, you know, why this or that happened. You know, just people just have theories. And then later, maybe much later, social scientists can put together, you know, studies and data and tell you, well, there's a good chance that this is what happened and why it happened. But at the moment, it's just, you know, competing opinions. And so that's being exploited, too. There's just conflicting visions of what kind of a country we are, what kind of a country we should be. You know, the truth is kind of some little wiggly thing that's...
I ask myself daily the question, when did morals become subjective?
Morals being subjective, I think you can go all the way back to the founding of the country. And the decision that settlers here made that Black people from Africa were less than human and could be owned as property and used for free labor on which to build their economy. And in order to maintain the fiction that this was okay, that you were an upright Christian while you were doing this, you had to make these people subhuman, because if they were human like you, it wouldn't be Christian to do it, would it? But you could do it to a horse. You could put a horse on, attach a horse to a plow, or a mule or an oxen to a plow, and make them work. And all you gave them in return was food to keep them alive. So you've crossed a moral bridge from which there is no return. When you say this Black person from Africa is no different than my horse or my mule or my oxen, And that is deeply embedded in this country, especially in the South. But even in parts of, the Northerners own slaves too. So, the idea that you can get something for nothing, which, let them do all the heavy lifting while we sit on the porch and drink mint juleps. There's a moral vacuum there that is just so enormous that, I don't know. It's just sort of beyond words. Now, there are people that have pointed this out, like James Baldwin and Frederick Douglass and, other Black spokespeople. But some of them have found it, like Baldwin just couldn't live here anymore. He just couldn't take it. So it's a problem. I mean, in Australia, you had the Aboriginals, but they weren't enslaved, I don't think. Were they?
The short answer is yes. And I'm going to put some links to articles that discuss this topic in the show notes. On a personal note, I can say there are geographical areas in Australia where I felt a presence, an anger, a sadness just by standing in a particular area. And this made me consider whether the soil beneath our feet is capable of holding the memories of cruelty and anger and the opposite of love. I've noticed this in different parts of the world, and sometimes I think that I wonder if that has the ability to affect the people living in that particular area.
Yeah.
Anyway, getting back to books, on a positive note, many booksellers have told me that since the lockdown in March, they have received many requests for people wanting to read James Baldwin. So that is a positive out of a negative. Now, since we're back onto books, is there one book you'd like to recommend everyone read?
Well, that's really a tough question because there's just so many that come to mind right away. I think for really understanding the American character, everyone should read Moby Dick because it tells us who we are in relation to the natural world, and it tells us who we are in relation to each other as well, and how those two are intertwined. I can't think of a book that does it better than that.
And I have one last question. As a nonfiction writer, structure and planning are important. Do you write as you research or research and then write?
I do it in chunks. So obviously a book like Mavericks, I do one person at a time. When it was the Miller book, which was a whole life story, I did it in pieces. I would map out what I saw as the sections of the book. So there were, there was his Paris years. So that was a section. And I would research that, take a lot of notes as I'm researching. Occasionally I would get a flash of a passage that I wanted to be in the book, and I'd write it out. I wouldn't be exactly sure where it would go, but I felt like this is something I definitely want in the book. I want this said. And then I'd get to the point where I was sort of like, the tank is full. I don't need any more information. I'm starting to see the same piece of information over and over and over again in my research, so I can stop. And then I'll put it together. And the research may go on for 2 or 3 months, and the writing may take 4 days. It may just come rushing out in 4 days. And I write longhand on pads. And then as soon as I've done my writing for the day, the next day I type it up, I polish it, because I find that it's sort of like you're building a wall. You want every brick to be in the right place and well cemented before you keep adding to the wall. Otherwise, the whole thing will come down if you haven't made it solid. I'm not like, oh, dump it all out and then fix it. Don't dump it all out. When it comes out, it's already fixed.
Well, Arthur, I have thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you, and I'm sure we could continue for hours.
Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to ask me these questions and listen.
You're welcome. And where can people find you?
At www.arthurhoyle.com is my website. On that site, you'll find links to everything that I've published, my two books and a number of essays that I've published in zines. On Twitter, I'm Art Hoyle. I have a small following. I'm not a big Twitter freak. I use Facebook in several ways. I use it to stay in touch with people that are around the world. I have friends in England and Turkey and Greece and Thailand. You know, I have people that I've met on my travels that we've stayed in touch through Facebook. It's kind of nice. But then I've jumped into different groups on Facebook that are, you know, supporting authors, or, you know, Biographers International is a Facebook group that I belong to, and so on. So those are places that you can find me and, you know, drop in.
Once again, Arthur's website is arthurhoyle.com. And thank you for listening. Remember, buy local, read global, support your local indie bookshop. I'll see you around the corner. For updates about the show, make sure to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Mandy Jackson Beverly.